go.
We're tin heavy on this guy.
Somebody coming?
Carol.
Oh, Carol, yeah. What's the other hand say? Oh, no. Okay. Well, shall we begin with a bow? Usually start with a bow here?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's... My name's Walter. I am from Boulder. I live pretty near the Shambhala Center in Boulder. I've been studying meditation 35 years now. And I'm very happy to be here to conduct a class or discussion or whatever you want to call it. This is my first time to see this wonderful new location, and I'm very happy to see that. And I wish everybody the greatest benefit and pleasure to derive from this place. And I hope Kristen about getting it insured.
Do you want a little table to put your notes on?
Sure, yeah. What I'd like to do, though, as I said, my name is Walter. I'd like to hear everybody else's name. I know a couple already, and a couple I don't know. So, tonight's topic is going to be joy. And so, just to break the ice on the evening, as we go around, here's what I'd like. Your name, and one time recently or not so recently when you experienced joy. Just, 20 words or less on that. So I'll start. My name is Walter, and last weekend I went to see the movie called Joy. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
And it gave me a lot of joy. I might say something about it, not a plot spoiler, but I might say something about it as we progress here. And so sometimes that can be joyful.
I'm Bill. Joy. Joy. We had a granddaughter that comes some Thursday nights, and she came tonight, and it was very nice. That's joy. It was,
yeah, thank you.
Very good.
My name's Tim, and I think most recently was this morning when I actually have a cat who likes to sit and have, when I have coffee and read the paper, and he jumps up on my chest and he kind of sits there. And I realized how comforting and nice that is, as silly as it sounds.
My name is Tim, too, and probably about the most joyful thing I've ever had in my life is when my daughter was born. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you brought up the joy. My name's Mary Jane. And
was it Mary Jane, did you say?
Mary Jane?
Yeah. Okay.
And I was sitting with my cat and my dog and my other dog all around me, just kind of huddled in, and they don't do that always, but and that does give you just a real kind of feeling of tribe coming together.
My name's Lee, and I'm going to stick with the same theme. When I meditate in the mornings, I have a really old cat, and she lives for it. She comes in, and I put a blanket over my lap, and then a little bit of it is in front of me. And she always lays down right in front of me. And a lot of times when I'm meditating, she just stares at me, and that almost brings me a lot of joy.
Who's going to get enlightened first?
Probably her.
I'm Carol. Gosh, there are so many things. So many. One of the most wonderful, most joyous times in my life was when I was attending the Sangha retreat in 2012. At the Shambhala Mountain Center, when Sakyam had just returned from his year's retreat. And a recent joyful time was on Sunday afternoon when my great nephews were at our house. They are so amazing. They're 1 and 4. So it's just total joy when they're there, even when they cry.
I'm Kristen. I have a lot of moments with my son that bring me joy. Most recently, I suppose, there are a couple that are coming to mind, but on the snow day, we went out, put our snow clothes on, and just went over to the park and just ran around like crazy people in the snow and just didn't have a care in the world. And we were laughing. I had the day off work, and he was out of school, and we were just laughing and throwing snow on each other and rolling around in it, and we made a big crop circle in the snow, and, you know, it was just, we were just free, and that was a very joyful feeling.
I'm Richard, and let's see, Saturday or Sunday, this lady was ringing these bowls.
Yeah.
And we would, I put my hands out like this, and it seemed like the energy was being modulated by the tone, and it got stronger. And, you know, it seemed very real to me, but nobody else caught on to it. But that brought joy to me to feel that strange energy.
Thank you. Thank you. This, we probably should do this every day, is just communicate some joyful moment to somebody else or to the cat or somebody who wants to hear about it. A little, maybe diversion here, but maybe not. Melissa Robinson, who invited me to come here, suggested or included in her invitation that I should say something about who is Trungpa Rinpoche and who is Sakyong Mipham. Now, is that going to be completely redundant here, or should I carry on a little bit with it? Okay. I know, Kristen, you told me you were recently arrived, so. Trungpa Rinpoche, do we have a picture of Trungpa Rinpoche?
Not yet. It's going to go up here.
It's going to go where? Right there?
It's going to go up there.
Yeah, okay.
Probably doing one of the books. You want me to
look at? Please. Sacred Path has got a nice picture near the back.
Okay.
Sergei Trumkov was born in 1939 in Tibet, and joined a long line of, I mean, a line going back to the Buddha 2,500 years before, of teacher-to-student relationships. And he was recognized soon after his birth, 2 or 3 years old, that he was said to be the rebirth of a previous incarnation of this energy. And, you know, I'm not saying I believe that completely, but, you know, that's the Tibetan point of view, is that these people are very special and have the ability to bring themselves back to the same environment and take the teachings again. So that was where Trungpa landed. He landed in a situation where the most exclusive, detailed, thoroughgoing teachings of Tibet were made his at an early age with a very strict tutor. And so he learned an enormous amount. And he was abbot of a monastery and whatnot. When all of that fell apart rather dramatically in 1959, when Trungpa was, not in fact, the whole scene was invaded by the Chinese, and their occupation was intensified to the point that Trungpa and many others, including the Dalai Lama that we've all heard of and know, they decided that the best thing to do in terms of preserving the teachings was for them to leave Tibet and go to India, which they did on foot under cover of darkness and circuitous paths to avoid the Chinese army and so on.
It's pretty dangerous, but that's the only one I could find. And here's the Sakya. That's pretty sweet, sorry. Way of the Warrior.
Okay, anyway, here's a nice picture of him. If you turn it around. Well, the most significant thing that I can say at this point is that he figured out in India rather directly that his path in life was going to go way beyond the teaching of monks, which is where he landed in India, teaching in a school for young lamas. But he therefore made it his project to study English for the next 10 years until 1969. He studied English in India and also went to England as a Spalding Fellow at the University of Oxford. And soon after that, he married in England. He married an English woman, and he came to North America. He came to Colorado in 1970, and the rest is history, you could say. People in Boulder had gotten enthusiastic about him, although they hardly knew him, the ones that invited him, but he came, he clicked with them, and many other students heard that he was in Colorado, so many people came to Boulder, and the whole thing took root in Boulder. We're about to celebrate the 40th anniversary. That would make it 1976, when the building in Boulder, the Boulder Shambhala Center, when that building was acquired. He began moving his teachings building centers in cities all over the map, Europe, America, Australia, New Zealand, He died in 1987, having written vast quantities here. This book, for instance, that I have here, this book is the Bodhisattva Path of Wisdom and Compassion. This is actually a three-volume work that I've been studying recently, as a Hinayana part, a Mahayana part, and a Vajrayana part. Well, meanwhile, he had a son in India. 1962 was born Sakyong Mipham. And now the funny thing is, you might have noticed that the father, Trungpa Rinpoche, liked wearing Western clothes. You saw the picture of him with a necktie on, a suit and whatnot. Whereas his son just wouldn't go the same way. The son likes brocades and Oriental style gowns and whatnot. So they're not exactly the same. So Sakyong Mipham has been our guiding teacher for, he was crowned in Halifax in 1995 and has acquired at that time the title Sakyong, and he's been going strong ever since. That book came out in 2005, and that was the book that hooked me on the Sakyong, was that very book right there. Other people may have other stories on that. So he's, of course, completely fluent in English, went to Boulder High School for a while, and also had vast amounts of teaching in India and whatnot. So he's, well, I hope everyone will come Tuesday morning to Boulder to see him in person at the Shambhala Day celebration starting at 9 o'clock. Okay, that was about what I wanted to say about Trungpa Rinpoche and Sakyong Mipham. Any questions? Or I left out the most important thing, and you better say it now. Mary Jane, did you have any questions?
Any questions? Well, I'm more listening and taking in than I have questions, I think.
Okay. We'll have a pop quiz at the end. Okay, so my topic here is joy. And it was good to have that little exercise of saying something about joy. We're all experiencing joy. We know it. And yet, we're also Buddhists, or maybe Buddhists, or fellow travelers, or welcome guests, or whatever we are. We have some kind of a vision or view of what Buddhism is, and a lot of times in the popular imagination, the view of Buddhism isn't all that joyful. I mean, what is the popular view of Buddhism? Anybody want to say, Carol?
I think it depends so much on what the person has had contact with. For a lot of people, the Dalai Lama is their concept of Buddhism, and for other people, it's somebody like Jon Kabat-Zinn. Maybe Suzuki or one of the other Zen leaders, Thich Nhat Hanh. And I think it is true that I would say teachings about joy would not be the first thing that would come to people's mind when they think of Buddhism, at least the people I know.
Yeah. Well, the Dalai Lama, he kind of radiates joy, actually,
yes.
some way. But what I was thinking of here is that the word suffering seems to be, if one's had a little bit of training or read something about Buddhism, we get the idea that suffering is there. And in the history of Buddhism, the early history, maybe the first 500 years, corresponds somewhat to the Hinayana period in our own instruction. Hinayana meaning lesser vehicle of your sort of first path, when path of just sitting a lot. And that path, particularly in those first 500 years, was not very joyful. It was, what was the goal in those early forest-dwelling monks, the renunciates, the ones who just had one garment and one begging bowl, and that was it? What was their goal?
It seems like, you know, asceticism was kind of the driving force, and it, you know, came from the Hindu.
Yeah, there was a whole milieu where yes, asceticism was there. And so this word cessation was, or whatever the Sanskrit equivalent is, but in English they say cessation. That was the goal. So cessation of desires, if desire is a problem, and if attachment's a problem, well, okay, we'll work on it with cessation, which is closing down, kind of coming in, letting the heart beat slower, nothing exciting, no Facebook,
no television.
No television, yeah, and one meal a day, or at least no meal afternoon, and well, this was, you know, a fantastic period in Buddhist history. Most of what we call the Abhidharma, the detailed analysis of how the mind works through the medium of meditation, most of that was formed in that period. But nevertheless, it sounds pretty joyless when you hear about endlessly reducing craving. Even sometimes you hear about, you mentioned Suzuki Roshi, well, sometimes the Zen things sound a little joyless also. You know, sleep deprivation and chopping wood and working on koans. There's a book I like. I think I mentioned it in this seminar once before. There's a book by Stephen Batchelor called Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. Have you seen this book?
No.
It's very, revealing to read this book, because he talks about 20 years of study, where, as far as anyone reading the book can tell, there was no joy whatever. He spent 10 years with a Tibetan teacher who just for 10 years told this guy, go back to your sadhana. Sadhana is a kind of a recitation of aspirations. And then he got, didn't work for him, so he spent 10 years in Korea at a Zen monastery, and in this case it was go back to your koan for 10 years. Go back to your koan. A koan is one of these Japanese riddles. And as I was reading that book, I was thinking, you know, I'm just so sad this guy didn't meet Trungpa Rinpoche, did not meet Chögyam Trungpa, did not meet his son, because a lot of what I'm getting at today is that those teachers, the teachers we have right now and have had for 40 years here, they have put joy in one form or another at the center of their teachings both by precept and by example. I'll be getting to that. I'm going to make you work on that too. But my brother, here's an example. My brother, we were talking about something I had done meditatively, and I mentioned that my suitcase would have a tie in it, a necktie and some other decent clothes. And he was so surprised. He's totally startled, in fact. He said, "Oh, I thought you just wore old sweatpants for that." And I said, "No, it's a whole different scene here with this this group. There's some kind of upliftedness that I'm looking for." So to underline this, I want to review something, or introduce, if need be, something called the three marks of existence. Anybody want to go for it? What are the three marks of, or one of them?
Impermanence.
Say it loud.
Impermanence.
Yeah, impermanence is the first one, yeah. Impermanence. And another one I've already said once today is suffering, or sometimes dissatisfaction or unsatisfactoriness or unable to make it work somehow. It just never quite works. And the third quality of existence is egolessness. That this whole charade that I go through of trying to prove I exist, setting up everything so everything will be just right for Walter, that's phony. That there's something, that the center that we try to feel there doesn't really exist. There's a great flurry of thoughts, emotions, speech, eating, sleeping, whatever. And it's all endless thoughts trying to put it together in one kind of centralized way. But that center doesn't really make sense. And the whole thing is actually subject to impermanence and going to die anyway. And there, of course, they're all three related, because impermanence is related to dissatisfaction. The reason you can't get satisfied ultimately is that you're looking for something that doesn't exist. You're looking for some way to get settled, some permanent solution, some way to feel right once and for all, and close the door once you get it right. So those three things are related. And they kind of echo the joyless quality. I mean, how could there be any joy when we're talking about life that's impermanent? And it's a struggle anyway. And there's going to be suffering no matter what you do. Even good karma leads to suffering, he says. And our cherished ego is an illusion. Well, the Buddha said these things not just to startle us or put the damper on our fun, but also as a path to wisdom. Because through meditation, we can actually see these things. It's no good just hearing about them, or it's of little use anyway. Have somebody say, "Oh yes, it's impermanent," but to actually feel that. And the path there, of course, is meditation. You know, as we sit there and follow the breath in and out and observe what happens with our thinking, we can see the kind of sandcastles built by the ego and how it's just a churning thought. We can actually see our mind crank up suffering, and we can see the impermanence of the thoughts and all they stand for. So we could just leave it at that. Leave it at, okay, this is the path to wisdom. Let's sit down and follow.
Don't you think the joy comes when you give up the attachment?
Yes, okay. So we're going to go right into the joy.
I mean, that is because everything is, the attachment is what sets it all up, you know. So, I mean, that seems to me, and the impermanence, that's just the state that it is, that's just the attachment. That's the norm. But it's the attachment.
It's the attachment. So, let me back up here a sec. Maybe we could really get into joy now. What joy is there in impermanence? In just being aware of impermanence. Is there any joy there, or is it grim?
It's amazing how things change.
Yeah.
The natural cycles, the lives of animals, plants.
The lives of animals, plants.
Wonder.
And movement. That, you know, movement brings me a lot of joy. Running, skiing, and stuff. And that only happens because of change.
It only happens because of change, right?
Mm-hmm. Impermanent.
Our whole life. Our whole life is based on that, and. You mentioned the natural cycle. What's the natural cycle that we're feeling the cold part of right now? It's our seasons and our all of that. When I was a kid, you only got berries a certain time of year, and it was joyful. Now you buy them any day of the week. But still, there a few things are still seasonal. And there is some kind of joy in that, and there's joy in seeing the children, or grandchildren, or great nephews, or whatever. And the only way you're going to get joy out of children is if us old people kind of fade away at some point.
Since when I was a little kid, my dog got hit by a car and it killed him. I remember the feeling then, and the feelings continued when anybody or any animal close to me has died since then. And when that happens, when I was a little kid, I told my mom that I never wanted that feeling to go away. And that sadness, to me, is the closest feeling to real joy I experience. And it always fades. And I'm always so disappointed it fades. But right after someone that I love dies or comes close to death or is ill, I feel like that's the closest thing to joy I ever feel. And but it's sadness. And to me, when I feel that feeling, to me they're the same.
Thank you so much for saying that.
It's the same source, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're so close. They're,
mm-hmm.
If you study what Trungpa has said, particularly in the Sacred Path of the Warrior, he talks about sad joy and the combination of sadness and joy as being the really most genuine emotions. I remember when Richard's wife died, and I hope you don't mind my saying this, but it was that kind of sad joy was there too, don't you think?
It was the joy just knowing her.
Yeah. And so, oh, you got me. It's really, really beyond speech, actually, some of that. But struggle.
There's a richness associated with the impermanence, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's the sad and the joy. It's all there.
Yeah.
And it's much richer than hanging on.
Yeah, like a miser or something. When everything comes together, in a person or a season or a beautiful meal that you made, or meals, totally impermanent, but it can be, you know, things come together, and maybe once only in mm-hmm. certain ways. I made a dish last week that I can't remember how I did it. It's never going to happen again. So. You've probably done that too. I don't know. And all our struggle, one way to find joy in the struggle is, well, maybe somebody else wants to say, in not necessarily in the struggle, but in observing our struggle and learning how that works, we can actually reveal a lot about ourselves. And, moreover, we can see how other people work. We see that our craving or immoderate fantasies, whatnot, really lead us into suffering. And then we meet somebody who's maybe not acting the way we would like them to act. It might occur to us that, well, yeah, that person also is experiencing the truth of the Buddha. They're struggling, and their struggle is coming out in being acted out a little bit. And I know what they're doing. I've actually experienced that myself. So it means we can begin to take the broader view and actually think of somebody else's suffering. Put that first in our mind.
I think there's a lot of joy in struggling to, maybe not in the struggle so much as in realizing, understanding, learning. I feel like it's a real source of joy. And I guess I have to say the struggle is part of it too. It's just, I don't think about that so much. But the as you were saying, realizing that I can identify with others, I don't have to be locked in one egotistical being.
You want to say something, Bill?
No. It's just that in one way, life is hilarious that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Joey has a lot to do with sense of humor, actually. Okay, now I've got a dozen or ten, anyway, things on my list here of other places in the Buddhist path, particularly as outlined by Trungpa and others, where joy plays a role. And I could just read off my list, but I'm actually curious to hear from some of you. Where does joy come up in some other places you've...
The Buddha, the Dharma says, always maintain a joyful heart.
Always maintain a joyful heart, yes. That's the fourth thing on my list here. Yeah, great minds think the same. Yeah, well, what does that mean?
It means that you, whatever happens, you have a joyful heart, so that you you kind of let things happen, and if you plan things, they never happen the way you want them to. But if you let things happen, you can enjoy what happens. There's something about what happens that, is not a bad thing.
How do you get to this state, Richard?
Through meditation, perhaps.
Through meditation, yeah. Well, we experience that. I mean, I think, you know, always maintain, you know, if we insist on always in a literal sense, okay, none of us are there. But maybe if we relax and say, do we sometimes actually experience that, maintaining a joyful mind?
Well, the heart can be joyful and the mind can be sad.
That's great, yeah. So sometimes, anybody notice this after a long period of meditation, maybe a Sunday morning here or something like that, that some kind of joy just arises spontaneously? Tim, you want to say anything on that?
I've experienced that, but I guess it, for me, it's going to come along with sort of a sense of letting go, you know, during that period of meditation,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Is that the, you know, it's not sort of escaping from the cares, but they just sort of melt into the background of, you know, now kind of thing.
Yeah, and when we can have that sort of relaxed state, then maybe it is possible sometimes that we will discover a joyful heart. And
I had an experience where the only time I've really kind of, I don't know if bliss is the same as joy, but felt blissful because of meditation. I was in Nepal, and it was really hot, and I was sick, and I was in this room. It was up like the top of this monastery, and there was a Rinpoche just speaking Tibetan as fast as you can speak Tibetan, and I had no idea what was going on. It was extremely uncomfortable, and I was sitting on the floor, and there was a fly buzzing around my head, and all of a sudden, I just felt so happy, but none of the suffering went away. Like, I continued to be uncomfortable, and the fly didn't leave, and it continued to be hot, but I think I finally just was over it, because I had a fever, and it was really uncomfortable, and then all of a sudden, I just was, just the whole situation was wonderful. But I didn't feel, I felt, my heart felt wonderful, but my mind still, it was still like, oh, fly, and it's hot, and you know, I've got to go to the bathroom, and like all that kept going on, and I was happy all of a sudden.
Okay, yeah, that's wonderful. Anything else? Places where joy might be seen in our teaching, or things we have received.
Raising Windhorse and the Great Eastern Sun, really all about joy, I think.
Okay. Where'd that book go? I don't have time to really talk about this at length, but in this book there's a chapter on what's called Windhorse. I think this is the right book. Yeah, second chapter. And it means an enlightened state. So people were invited, and we're invited to actually kind of raise our spirits and, you know, open our eyes, see the world. So he says in here you could just kind of sit and say, oh, yeah, let's cheer up and be a little brighter today. And if we do that, and it's a Tibetan phrase that translates as wind horse, and there's a sort of mental image of this fabulous wind in your face, and you're on a horse, so you have a certain amount of power, and you have a kind heart, and you're able to move into situations in not an aggressive way, but in a kind-hearted way. And actually, so much of what Trungpa taught was this thing or the other thing or the next thing, all pointing toward greater wind horse and therefore greater joy. For instance, clothes. Trungpa wanted people to dress nicely. He himself wore the ties and suits from Savile Row and all that, but it doesn't have to be a tie, but something nice that can actually perk us up. Something, the waking up of coming out of our sleep of the cocoon, that waking up can be expressed in the body, as he sometimes called it head and shoulders. Do you have head and shoulders, or are you more like an animal or something? So all of that was part of the joy. For children, there's something called sun camp. Have you heard of sun camp? Oh, we have to talk about sun camp. I think they start at 9 or 10.
10 to 16.
Yeah. Believe it or not, kids come out of this camp joyful. Their root practice, the thing they do the most, is they drill. Marching. Left, right, in formation. And somehow they make it so that kids love this. And while they're going, they sing little ditties about being kind to people and stuff like that. And they, you know, have teams. And there's a whole camp morale there, but somehow this genius of the Trungpa figured out that teaching drill would somehow hit children's wavelength. And so they also have it for adults if you want, but in some programs. So there was one thing, and there was a period, and I know Bill remembers this, when Trungpa wanted everybody to waltz. He would have these waltzing parties, particularly on Shambhala Day, and with an orchestra and a dance floor. And if you didn't know how to waltz, there were people there for training. And it was, you know, the whole nine yards of, we will do this thing. And of course, the clothes went with it, and lots of alcohol, and in those days, cigarettes, and it was really quite over the top, this thing. But the idea there, again, was that, you know, even though we're talking about suffering and our struggles and all that, we still can somehow do something uplifted. And in this case, it was a community effort. And anybody else remember that, those days?
Okay. We used to have the Shambhala Ball.
They called the Shambhala Ball, it was called, yes. And Trungpa was there in his tuxedo, and so may seem over the top. I mean, he was a crazy wisdom teacher, so-called, and seemed crazy sometimes, but that really did it. Oh, so many things. I've got a couple of books by Pema here. I guess I prepared for 2 hours instead of 1 hour.
Can you tell us your list of 10 things?
Okay, I'll try to just read them off here. First thing was, we have a class called Joy in Everyday Life. Joy in Everyday Life, no prerequisites. Everybody here can take it. 5 evenings or 5 mornings or sometimes 1 weekend. So, and part of what I'm doing here is I'm sort of playing off that class to find this material. And second thing, the third Brahma Vihara. This is a way of meditating on other people's joy. I'm so glad that my neighbor, you know, won the lottery, or whatever. I'm so glad that this other person at work got praised by the boss. that kind of practice is in Pema's books.
It's in this book.
Here. Pass that around. Third thing was the celebration of enlightened genes, or celebrating our basic goodness. That's joyful. Then the fourth thing was Atisha's slogan about maintaining a joyful heart. Fifth thing was rejoicing in our human birth. This is a practice we do sometimes, of we just contemplate how wonderful it was to have been born and to therefore be in a position with the right kind of ears, intellect, and eyes to hear the teachings. Animals can't hear the teachings. So this human birth is a cause for joy. The sixth thing was rejoicing in ordinary things. Pema has something to say about that. Actually, ordinary things are a cause for joy. We sort of said that right at the start.
Well, and it was called, wasn't it, the Cheval training was called Everyday Magic.
Yeah, Everyday Magic. Yes. The seventh thing was dedicating joy to others. And Pema also has a... Whenever we have some joy, it's like we could say, may others have this joy too. And she says it's like, suppose you're eating a strawberry, she says in this book. Now, should you feel guilty about the strawberry? You know, there's all those Syrian refugee camps where nobody gets to eat a strawberry, therefore I'm going to spit this one out. And she says, no, that's not right. The actual thing is to really appreciate it. You know, don't waste it, so to speak, but actually appreciate it and then wish that others may have the same kind of wonderful experience. Next thing, eighth thing, is a mixture of joy and sadness that we talked a little bit about. The ninth thing was emptiness and bliss, which I'm not going to go into. The tenth thing was things like waltzing and drilling and kudo and flower arranging and some other things like that. So those were the 10 things. Anybody want to say anything? I think my time is used up here. It's been fun talking about this. And if there's any takeaway, it's that, you know, this Buddhist world is large. And there is a lot of joy here, there, and the other place. And it's not completely killjoy type situation.
And it's not separate from sadness.
And it's not separate from sadness. It's not separate from experiencing impermanence.
Yeah.
It's not separate from our experience altogether. Any final comment?
There's a story about this monk who, a girl accused the monk he was the father of her child. Mm-hmm. And he didn't deny anything. He said, "What do you want me to do? You take the child." So for a year, he took the child. And then she came back to him and said, "No, you're not the father." He gave the child back. And each experience was a joy for him. He enjoyed the child while he took care of it.
Boy, it would be hard to enjoy giving it back, I think.
Well, to be joyful, yes, he could see the joy in giving it back to the mother. Okay. You might say, well, what about the child? And but that's only a thought.
That's only a thought. Okay, we could bow and close. And,
we have announcements. Saturday morning is our sitting from 9 till, we'll be here from 9 to noon. We sit till about 11:30 and have refreshments. And as Walter mentioned, next Tuesday is Shambhala Day. It's the beginning of the Tibetan year. It's New Year's Day. And Sakyong is going to be in Boulder speaking. And the things going on in Boulder start at 9 in the morning and go until, it says 12:30, but time in Shambhala is pretty flexible. So that's an opportunity to meet the Sakyong if you haven't met him yet. Next Friday is the day we would normally have a movie here. We haven't had one yet, but we've decided not to do it because there's a big event going on in Boulder on Friday night. It's a celebration of 40 years of the Shambhala Center. And then a week from Saturday morning up at Chautauqua is a Lasung, which is a smoke offering. Big event. If you've never been to one, it's quite interesting. I think that might be... That's what's going on, right?
And that's a big joy event, the Lasung.
Yeah, yeah.
All these events are, really.
Yeah. And then we'll be here.
And there's the feast...
Tuesday night.
The Sun
Mudra.
No, it's the Shambhala Sadhana, isn't it?
No, I think it's
Mahamudra.
Mahamudra.
For new moon.
Yeah.
That's a shocker, too, so
yeah.
Better go to that. And
in fact, Tuesday morning will be the Shambhala Sadhana, which is a practice that the Sakyong wrote in early 2011, that's normally only for people who've taken a lot of classes, but it's open to everyone on Shambhala Day. So, it's a great opportunity. I think that's all we have to say.
And don't forget the Joy in Everyday Life class.
Yeah. Do you know when that's happening?
No.
But you can find it on the website.
Yeah. In Boulder or probably in Fort Collins, either way.
And there's another class, Meditation in Everyday Life, which also has no prerequisite.
Yeah, so. And Contemplation in Everyday Life.
That does.
Does that have a prerequisite?
Contentment in Everyday Life.
Contentment.
I've been saying it wrong. Excuse me. Contentment's the one with no prerequisite.
Oh, Joy is.
Joy does have contentment. It's a prerequisite.
Oh, well. Anyway. I think that's it. Thank you very much, Walter.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Very nice.
It's been a joy having you.
Good job. I was waiting for that. Now I can go home happy.
I think Bill here exudes joy most of the time. A little bit I've been around him.
I'm very fortunate to have a good sense of humor. Oh, okay. Let's see.